In India, as throughout the developing world, 7 of 10 people subsist by farming. But those farmers are now being forced off their farmland, and within 5 years or so, India alone expects to have about 400 million farm refugees. This leads us to ask, what will the world's poor do when they can no longer farm?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 654th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Cusco who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the board.
So hello, glad Dave. Glad to be here.
Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello there.
Folks, though 7 out of every 10 Indians depend on income from the farm, they are losing farmlands to the world-ranging corporations. These giant food pirates, as they are called by India's Dr. Davinda Sharma, have already gained control of an estimated 50 million acres of prime farmland in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. When these food pirates gain control of farmland, they work hand-in-hand with government to force the poor off the land. India alone will have an estimated 400 million agricultural refugees by 2015, says Dr. Sharma. Farming villages have turned into ghost communities and cities into shanty towns. This is not only true of India, but it's also being felt all over the developing world. Dr. Sharma's observation leads us to ask, what will the world's poor do when they can no longer farm? And who better to ask this question than the award-winning author and journalist from New Delhi, India, Dr. Davinda Sharma. Welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Good to have you back. Been 6 years. Holy smokes, a little bit of water under the bridge. You're visiting from India, United States. You're doing a tour. On whose behalf are you checking out the country now?
Well, this time it is the group called Indian Friends Association based in Los Angeles, and along with the Association for India Development. So they would like me to travel around in the country for the next fortnight, speak to various groups at various places in America.
Well, good. And we're happy to have you aboard. 6 years ago, as I said, we were talking about how we were going to feed the exploding populations of the developing world. And given what we have seen in the news as of late, it seems like we're running into some trouble in that regard. True?
Yes, and that's a very, very big concern, I suppose, And we have already seen in 2007, 2008, we have seen the world passing through an unprecedented food crisis, with the prices spiraling, and, even in America, Walmart going in for rationing of rice, and the developing world, most of them who were the exporters of rice, stopping the export of rice, wheat exports stopped, and there was scarcity of food all around. 37 countries witnessed food riots. One country forced the government to be displaced in Haiti. And so I think it is quite apparent that food is now becoming a major concern all over.
Well, let's step back a little bit into the 1960s and talk about Dr. Norman Borlaug, who is known here by some as the father of the Green Revolution. He recently passed away at the age of 95. But Davinder, you watched him in action and even sparred with him a little bit on some of the philosophical issues of the time.
Yeah.
Dr. Borlaug won the Nobel Prize for ending famine in India and Pakistan, and it was one of the great stories in human history, and you were there to watch it. Very few of us Americans know about this story, so would you kind of tell us a little bit about what was going on in the early 60s and the difference he made?
Well, I think it's one of the greatest developments that took place was Borlaug's introduction of the miracle wheat varieties in India, Egypt, Pakistan, and Mexico, of course, and that triggered off the Green Revolution. But it wasn't easy. When Borlaug was trying to market or to promote his dwarf seeds, and where else, in the world you would try that in a country which was written off as a country, which would, let's say, half the country was expected to be led to a slaughterhouse by the end of 70s, and I'm talking about India. And that time, I think those people who were considered to be dooms, people who thought on those lines, I think went wrong because they did not visualize that something called as Green Revolution technology would come in. But it wasn't easy, let me tell you, and Borlaug tried his best to promote or to push those seeds into India.
But
and,
he didn't have much luck talking to the politicians of the time, did he?
Yes, and I remember in my discussions with him, because I used to be, at that time I used to be a journalist, and, hello?
Hello, I think we have somebody else.
Can you put on the phone, sir?
Maybe what we'll do is try calling you back and see if we can't get a better line. How's that for an idea?
Okay.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. I'll try to bring you up to speed if I can. We're talking with Dr. Davinda Sharmer, who is a award-winning author and journalist from India, and he specializes in agriculture issues. He's visiting the United States. When we last talked with Davinder, 6 years ago, almost to the day, and we were talking about how the world was going to feed the exploding populations of the developing world. And indeed, they were exploding. They're almost doubling every 10 years or so. The rate of growth was just mind-boggling. And in the interim period, within those 6 years, we have had a lot of trouble feeding the populations of the developing world. And so right now we're kind of going back to a time in the mid-60s when Davinder was a graduate student in an agricultural school in India. And an American named Norman Borlaug showed up on the scene with some newly developed hybrid strains of wheat that he said could end the famines that periodically ripped India and Pakistan. But you know what? He just couldn't convince the reigning politicians that such was the case. And so there he was in a state of almost famine in these two countries when millions of people were starving to death. And so we're going to try to pick him up and see if he can continue that story. Now, Davinder, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. So we're in India in the mid-1960s, and India and Pakistan are going through these periods of incredible famine, and Norman Borlaug showed up on the scene.
And what happens is Borlaug did try to push his wheat seeds, the dwarf wheat variety seeds, into India. And the government, there was a debate in India, and the government wasn't very, very enthused by that offer. But eventually, what Borlaug told me once was that he played the political rivalry card between Pakistan and India. So he said, if you are not going to take this seat, Pakistan will take it. And to Pakistan, he said, if you are not going to take it, then India will take it. So India imported 18,000 tons of dwarf seed from Mexico in the year 1966, and that triggered off the Green Revolution in India. At that time, it was called the Wheat Revolution. We had a record grain surplus the very first year. The next year, Pakistan imported 47,000 tons of wheat seed from Mexico. But unfortunately, as you know, Pakistan could not repeat that success model of Green Revolution that we have seen in India. And Pakistan remains a very major importer, a big importer of food even now. But that's a different story. Mm-hmm. But India put it the house in order, and we had the policies which would really encourage farmers within the country to produce enough food. And that is how the change took place. India stopped imports and became, quote-unquote, a self-sufficient country. So eventually, India became a net exporter.
And so India went from a state of complete dependence on the outside world for food to a country that was actually exporting food back to the world.
That's right. That's
right. And that was essentially the responsibility of one Dr. Norman Borlaug, who was so persistent in demanding that they take these seeds, and it worked. And for that, he was given the Nobel Peace Prize. But it has been said that Dr. Norman Borlaug almost single-handedly made it possible for the world to host an extra 1 billion people.
Mm-hmm. It is true.
And now this extra billion people are being run off the land by what you call food pirates, right?
That's right.
So Now we're going to take a quick break here in just a moment, but when we come back, we're going to talk food pirates and with Dr. Devinder Sharma, and we're going to talk about how food pirates are running poor farmers off the land all throughout the world and what the consequence of this is going to be for you and I and the rest of the world. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We have Dr. Devinder Sharma, who is an author and a journalist, an agriculturalist from New Delhi, India. He's visiting the United States, and we are so pleased to have him, because when we get back from this break, he's going to tell us all about the food pirates and how they are changing the world of agriculture throughout the world. Please do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, Dr. Norman Borlaug and his associates in the Green Revolution made it possible for the Earth to host an extra 1 billion people. The Green Revolution was the high technology agriculture that uses a lot of very expensive inputs like hybrid seeds, fertilizers, and pesticides. But through the use of those technologies, the Earth now hosts so many more people. And when we first started talking with Dr. Devinder Sharma about 8 years ago, 6 years ago, the question at hand was, how is the Earth going to feed all of these people? And as we have witnessed in the intervening years, we're having trouble feeding all of those people. Dr. Devinder Sharma from New Delhi, India, when Norman Borlaug was over there working, you and he seemed to get along, but you seemed to spar a little bit philosophically on the Green Revolution. Is that true?
Yes, because over the years I found that the Green Revolution ran out of steam. And it had created a lot of environmental crisis, or what is called as the second generation environmental impacts. You know, the water table plummeting down, mm-hmm. and the soil health devastated, the environment contaminated by pesticides. And I would normally sit with him and debate on him about these issues, but he wouldn't agree. His point was that this was something, you know, which was being raised by people who didn't want hunger to be removed. And in fact, I talked about the book that Rachel Carson had brought out, the monumental
Silent
work,
Spring.
The
mm-hmm.
Silent Spring. And I remember, and I wrote about him, about that particular interview of Borlaug in my newspaper at that time, and where he had said that, I asked him about how did he feel about the book, The Silent Spring, and his reply was, she is an evil force. And then he added by saying that, you know, these are the people who don't want hunger to be abolished. And his point was that pesticides are absolutely essential. And somehow, over the later year part of his life, he began to say that pesticides were harmful and we need genetically modified crops. And but in between, also, he was against genetically modification technology. He was against biotechnology. But I think he told me once that he spent 2 years in America working with a Nobel laureate, I don't remember his name, who wanted to expose him to biotechnology. And he said it was a waste of time. And but eventually, as the corporate control grew more stronger, I think Borlaug also began to accept genetic engineering as the way forward. So I think he was completely on the corporate track. Mm-hmm. You know, whether he did it intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know. But somehow I thought that was in variance with what the realities were.
So he did make it possible. He and his associates did make it possible for the Earth to host an extra billion people, and now we have an extra billion people.
That's right.
Who you say are being run off the land by food pirates. What do you mean by food pirates?
See, it's very tragic that, you know, the pirates at one time, of course, we know they came and robbed or took away our resources, whether it's financial or whatever. Now, this entire thing is moving into the hands of companies and countries where the effort is to go outside the country to acquire land, to buy land or to lease out land, to grow food there or grow crops which are required for commercial application like biofuels or palm oil and so on, and or ship it back to for domestic consumption.
So a large corporation from the United States, for example, might go into Latin America and buy up a bunch of farmland and grow crops, not for that Latin American country, but for the United States.
Yes, you are right, and you know, if I give you a couple of examples, in the last few years, we have seen today, 33 million hectares has been bought or leased out by companies in Asia, Latin America, and in Africa, and 33 million hectares would mean an area equal to that of Germany.
Wow!
It has already been acquired, and you know, all this will be the food produced will be shipped back to the countries from where these companies come from.
So these corporations are not necessarily just from the United States either. I think China's out there buying up a lot of land too, aren't they?
Yes, China is number one, in fact, and even India is falling in a very big way. And then we have the Middle East countries, you know, Saudi Arabia, and they have got a conglomerate which is trying to buy land because they realized in 2007, 2008 that they had the money, you know, but they didn't have the food was not available. So they thought they'll go ahead and try to buy land to grow food rather than, you know, have the money and sit over it here.
Huh. So... and I guess obviously that they'll buy the land in these countries where there is really no market for their food, right?
That's right. No, let me give you an example. A classic example is Ethiopia. Ethiopia is a country we all know is always saddled with starvation or hunger crisis. You'll be surprised that today 8,000 companies are vying for land in Ethiopia.
Wait a minute. 8,000 companies?
All over the world.
All over the world are trying to buy land in Ethiopia?
Ethiopia. And this includes 80 companies from India. And Ethiopia has promised to this year to bring about 2.7 million hectares to be given to these companies.
Well, and none of that food is going to stay in Ethiopia, is it?
And the bigger problem, you're right, because the bigger problem Ethiopia faces is 5 million people live in hunger in Ethiopia. So who's going to produce food for those 5 million people? I think we have abandoned the poor, not only in Ethiopia, but also in other parts of the world. Look at Madagascar. They had leased out roughly half their arable land to the Korean company, the Daewoo, which makes cars. And there was a kind of a political unrest, and that is why they have come back and taken off that deal.
Now, who do these food pirate corporations buy their land from?
Most often it is through the governments, you know, the governments which are facilitated, because, you know, they can't individually go and buy. Look at Pakistan, for instance. You know, Saudi Arabia is struck in a deal with Pakistan to buy 500,000 hectares of land. You know, companies couldn't have come and bought that land on their own. So the government is facilitating the process, and they will get investment, quote-unquote, foreign direct investment. So they are happy with foreign direct investment, and they are displacing the villagers, and they'll allow these companies to build up a kind of a autonomous region where they can grow crops and to be shipped back.
So essentially, a rich country like Saudi Arabia that is poor in natural resources,
that's right,
can go to a country that's rich in natural resources but poor in cash and buy off the government and take away the land.
That's right.
What happens to the people?
Well, the people are being displaced all over, and it's not only happening in Madagascar or in Pakistan that there is an unrest that we see, but all over the world where the land is being acquired, we see a kind of a simmering discontent brewing up into political storm now. People are realizing, you know, all these deals basically are hush-hush deals, you know,
mm-hmm.
but things are now coming out in the open. Like, for instance, Egypt, you know, Egypt had problems because, you know, Egypt is trying to buy land in Uganda, whereas its own land is also being bought by companies from outside. So it's a two-way process, and it's happening in various countries across the world, and there is a kind of unrest being witnessed in these countries. But the governments are being on the side of the corporates, so therefore they're trying to play it down or to run it down and so on.
Well, I was going to ask, why doesn't the government chase away the food pirates? But I guess if they're working hand in hand, on the deal if the government officials are obviously getting a lot of money themselves, right?
That's right. That's right. And I see no reason why the government should be doing that, but it's very sad and strange that governments all over the world are actually welcoming these kinds of initiatives. In fact, there was a meeting, a major conference being held in Zanzibar in mid-September where I was invited, but it has been postponed now. It was called the Arab Africa Summit, where the presidents of 10 African countries were actually hosting this meeting, inviting Arab countries to invest in land in Africa.
Well, okay, it's pretty incredible when you think about what you're saying here, then. Over 50 million acres, a land the size of the country of Germany,
has been
taken over by corporations that don't intend to grow food for the people of that country, but it rather intend to grow food for cash markets in larger metropolitan areas where city people live and have a lot of money. And then what happens to the city, the poor people of the farms? Boy, that's a lot of people that are going to be displaced, and what is the world going to do with them? That's the question we're working with today on The Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson, your host for the hour. Today we're talking with Dr. Davinda Sharma from New Delhi, and we're talking about what happens when the poor of the world can no longer farm, and they're displaced, literally chased off the land into cities. What do they do there? I guess we can kind of look here in the United States and see what happened to our poor farm families when they were chased off the land and they ended up in the city with nothing to do. Right back, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, in India, as throughout the developing world, 7 of 10 people subsist by farming. But those farmers are now being forced off their farmland, and within 5 years, India alone expects to have 400 million farm refugees. This leads us to ask, what will the world's poor do when they can no longer farm? And who better to ask than the award-winning author and journalist from New Delhi, India, Dr. Davinder Sharma. Dr. Sharma, you know, producer Carol Stafford came in and said, well, wait a minute. If somebody's buying all that land, somebody has to be selling it. So you can't really call them food pirates because pirates steal things. These people are buying things. Is that a fair enough summation?
I think basically pirates, as you rightly said, steal things. In this case, you are actually snatching food from the mouth of the poor people. And I think that's why I call them food pirates. You know, they know what they're doing. And of course, they're hand in glove with the governments, but they come basically to snatch food from those hungry mouths. And I think that is why I think they are food pirates.
So aren't the governments kind of thinking very short term here when they sell their precious farmland, or essentially they're giving it away for whatever, a few shekels or what have you? But they're really, aren't they creating them big problems for themselves down the road as all of these people move off the land to where they have something to do, to into the cities where they have nothing to do?
In a way, yes, what you are saying is right, but I think more important is that the mainline economic understanding all over the world now is that if we have to economically grow, then we have to have less dependence on agriculture, like the model that America has. You know, you have displaced people out of agriculture, and you think that is a model for development. But the tragedy here, Michael, is that look at a country like India, or for that matter, in percentage terms, all other developing countries. India has 600 million farmers.
India has 600 million farmers?
That's right, including the families, because families don't work separately. So 600 million farmers live off the land and are dependent upon agriculture directly. Mm-hmm. Now, 600 million farmers would mean every fourth farmer in the world is an Indian. Together with China, we make up half the world's farming population. Now, if you have to displace these people from agriculture, please tell me which country in the world or which group of companies in the world can provide employment to even 10 million people or 50 million people. And here we are talking about 600 million people. And the government of India's focus is, and the belief is, that if 70% of these farmers are not required, quote unquote, so they must be displaced. So therefore, the government of India's policies are to ensure that these people are offloaded or moved out from the rural into the urban areas. But my bigger worry is, what will they do in the urban areas? Where do we have employment opportunities for them? What are we not adding on to the crisis that we don't even visualize that we're going to face in the days to come?
Well, and that is the question. You know, we look around the streets of the United States, which has this wonderful industrial model, and what you see are a lot of young people standing on the street corners in hooded sweatshirts, you know, and you always wonder what kind of activity they have in mind, because they're not working and there's no place for them to work. And what happens when you move 600 million people off the farm? Where are they going to go? What does it look like in the countryside?
Well, the villages are becoming empty in India, but that will, of course, we have a huge population, as you know. But if you look at agriculture, in the last 15 years, we have had 200,000 farmers committing suicide.
Wait a minute. In the last how long?
15 years.
In the last 15 years, you've had 200,000 farmers commit suicide in
commit
India.
Commit suicide. And every hour, two farmers are committing suicide anywhere, somewhere in India. Now, this is because the entire economic equation has gone wrong for the farmers. It has become highly unsustainable. And also, there has been a government study by something called as the National Sample Survey Organization, the largest sample survey that we do in India. It estimates that 40% farmers want to quit agriculture if given a choice. So basically, what we have done is, over the years, we have made agriculture so unremunerative that, you know, the farmers are left with no choice.
Right.
They either have to kill themselves or they want to abandon agriculture.
Well, let's go back to the magic of the Green Revolution. And it kind of created this situation, didn't it?
It did. And I think the Green Revolution at one time did its job. But subsequently, what happened was, the negative impact, when it became visible, we forgot to do what is called as midterm correction. You know, we tried to address the problems, the ecological problems, the environmental problems, by more Green Revolution. Let's say the chemical fertilizer was not giving the required yield. So we said, apply more chemical fertilizer. So we went on applying more chemical fertilizer. The soil fertility has come down to almost zero. And so therefore, you are only dependent upon chemical fertilizers now. So you know, that way exacerbated the crisis. And now, it is because of the damage done to the natural resource base that the farmers in India are committing suicide. And that is the reason why we are heading this terrible agrarian crisis that we witness.
So it just kind of exacerbates itself. Once we developed the Green Revolution to feed more people came and were more hungry than ever. So we just kept pouring on the fuel, as it were. And the more we poured on, the worse things got. And now we're in a major pickle here, right?
Yeah.
So what happens when they go to the city? They all moved into town, right?
I was always thinking that the world should have been wise enough to at least warn us. In fact, in 1996, the World Bank came out with this World Development Report, where it mentioned that in India alone, you know, by the next 20 years, I'm talking about 1996, they said by the year 2015, the number of people who will be migrating from the rural to the urban areas will be equal to twice the combined population of UK, France, and Germany. Now, the combined population of UK, France, and Germany is about 200 million people. So the World Bank in 1996 had warned us, or had estimated, that 400 million people, and this is more than the population of America put together, in the United States, is going to move out of the rural areas in India into the urban centers. Now, I thought that was a warning. But if you look at the 2008 World Development Report produced by the World Bank, it actually facilitated the process by saying that land is an asset, and it is being unproductively used by the farmers and so on. So you need to move these people out into the urban area. So therefore, you need to set up 1,000 training institutes where you teach farmers to become industrial laborers.
Mm-hmm.
So that the translocation becomes easy. And so, you know, in India, the government of India has pumped in money to set up 1,000 industrial training institutes across the country, where the farmers will now be trained to use sickle and hammer, or whatever you call it, and so that they can become industrial labor. Now, this is the way the World Bank has been suggesting. So it's basically a design that I see. It is not only that the government of India wants to do it, or the government of Pakistan is doing it. It's because of the international design by the financial institutions that this process is taking place.
Wow. And the prognosis for all of this, I just think of all of those people 600 million people standing on the street corner with nothing to do. They'll all be well-trained, of course, but how much stuff does the world need? And so that's the question. What will the world's poor do when they can no longer farm? What do you think out there? We have with us Dr. Devinder Sharma, and award-winning author and journalist from New Delhi, India, and you have the opportunity to talk with him as well. All you have to do is pick up your phone and dial 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Love to hear from you, and love to hear what you have to say with to Dr. Devinder Sharma. We will be right back. Do stay tuned. Well, this from Dr. Devinder Sharma. India alone will have an estimated 400 million agricultural refugees by 2015. Farming villages are being turned into ghost communities and cities into shanty towns. This is not only true of India, but it is being felt all over the developing world. And so we ask, what will the world's poor do when they can no longer farm? Are they all going to be out there working in factories, manufacturing widgets for us? That's a lot of widgets, I guess. But you move 600 million people off the farm and into the cities. What are they going to eat, Dr. Sharma? Let's see. Here you go.
India believes and thinks is that, you know, with more of corporate agriculture taking place, you know, with more of corporate farming being encouraged, the corporates will produce food for the poor people. And so therefore you don't need farm, you don't need small farmers. So what exactly you are trying to encourage is the corporate agriculture, and they are facilitating all the kinds of processes that can build up this corporate farming models. And so the companies will produce food, and then that food will be delivered to the poor people.
But why sell it to the poor people if you could sell it to someplace else and make more money? I mean, it seems like, you know, the corporations that are going into the developing nations of the world to buy up farmland aren't buying up the farmland to sell food to poor people. They're buying up farmland to sell food to rich people.
I agree with you, Michael, entirely, and I think we forgot the message that came from Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi had said a country like India, I think the message is for everyone, is that a country should be ensuring a production system by the masses and not for the masses.
Oh, a country should be building production systems by
the
masses instead of for the masses.
Masses.
And of course, that's what we say. We say these modern technologies are going to be producing a lot of food for the masses.
Yeah.
But what are we doing with the masses in the interim? We're just shunting them off into the cities. What do the cities look like?
Well, of course, the cities are collapsing. As you know, India alone would have the largest number of metro cities building up in another 30 years or so. So the towns are becoming cities, the cities are becoming metros, and so on. But the other problem is, we're going to witness, is another problem of Naxalism. You know, the Naxalites who pick up gun is growing in India. When Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, the present Prime Minister, took over in the year 2004, I remember one of his talks where he said that 161 districts in India are afflicted with the Naxalites, you know.
Afflicted with what?
Naxalism, you know, where the poor people pick up gun and revolt against the state. And this is happening in India, 161 districts. You know, and India has about 620...
Wait a minute. You mean in 161 districts in India, the peasant farmers and the poor people are picking up guns and going up against the government?
Yeah, that's what's called Naxalism, you know. And it's a kind of terrorism, but it's basically confined to the land, the people who are displaced and so on. It's Maoism or you can Naxalism or you know. Mm-hmm. Now, 161 districts, out of the 626 districts we have in India. Now, this was in 2004. In 2009, we see that the number of districts which are affected by Naxalism is now gone up to more than 200, which means roughly one-third of India is sliding into the hands, or let's say is affected by Naxalism in India. Now, that is what is happening, and agriculture is the first defense against this kind of social upheaval. And when we destroy agriculture, this is what it leads up to.
Yeah. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
Yes.
And no agriculture, no sandcastles, I guess. And that's kind of what we're discovering here. Wow. That is incredible. And so the cities aren't faring. How do the government officials that allow this all to take place justify what's going on today?
You know, they somehow, you know, the entire thing is coming to the economic thought that we see all over the world. You know, we believe that the only way to grow economically is to move people out of agriculture into the urban centers, and then that adds on to the country's GDP growth. You know, when they come into farm or they deploy, sorry, when they come mm-hmm. from the farm into the cities to work as laborers, industrial output will go up and so on. Now, this is one of the assumptions that the government of India, and I think globally it is being promoted, and the WTO, the World Trade Organization, these kinds of treaties actually exacerbating the crisis, because they are opening up the global borders, national borders, trade borders, so that, you know, we can import cheaper food. And again, I take you back to what Mahatma Gandhi had said once. He had said, you know, importing food for a country like India is like importing unemployment. So when you import cheaper food from outside, you actually displace the small farmers first. So they become unemployed. So they are going to be a huge, huge crisis on the days to come. But somehow our thinking is that we need to displace these people to economically grow.
And this is going on all throughout the world too, right?
Not India is no exception. I mean, this is a model that is being followed all over. And I think India, because of its sheer size, I think it becomes easier for us to understand the stark implications that we're going to witness or we are witnessing in the process. But China is much worse if you look at China. In fact, people don't know. We talk about the economic boom in China, but Michael, you'll be surprised. In China, the level of unrest that we see in the rural area is phenomenal. You know, about 15 years back, there would be only 10,000 protests in the rural areas. This is published by the Newsweek magazine. I'm quoting them. And in 2005, they had 75,000 protests happening every year, which means about 250 protests every day in the rural areas of China. And most of these protests were linked to land, people being displaced off the land. So there were bloody protests also happening in China. But people just ignore that, and we talk about the economic boom that is taking place.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right back. Big question of all, where do we go from here, or do we go anywhere? Right back, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Well, every hour, two farmers in India commit suicide because they no longer have a farm. And millions, hundreds of millions of people are being displaced from farmland and chased into the cities where they have not much to do. And so, where do we go from here? We ask Dr. Devinder Sharma. And first, we're going to go quickly to the phones and pick up Rolf. Rolf, well, thank you for tuning in the Food Chain today.
Good morning.
Good morning. Fire away.
Dr. Sharma, thank you very much for your marvelous work. Briefly, I'm a biodynamic farmer. I'm an entrepreneur. I know India reasonably well. India, to me, is the wisest country. The question I have for you is, has the UN done any significant work to protect? And what about using Mexico, notwithstanding its problems, the country does not allow land to be sold, as a model that through the UN, that we just form large co-ops, and certainly for each significant country that has this problem of land going out and being thrown into the fangs of huge corporations, that we work in models like that? And do you have a website?
Dr. Sharma?
Well, I think what you are saying would be an ideal situation. But if you look at the UN FAO, the FAO is the only body internationally which is saying that the way the land is being bought or being taken over, it is dubbing it as a neocolonialism. But if you look at the other institutes, they are supporting it. Look at the International Food Policy Research Institute in Washington, D.C. IFPRI actually says there should be a code of conduct between the companies and the countries. If you look at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, it has actually gone into an agreement with a Saudi Arabian company to help build up agriculture, rice production in Pakistan and eventually in Philippines and so on. Now, which means the international institutes are also supporting this kind of takeover that is taking place. So I think eventually you will see the World Bank supporting it, and then of course the WTO would always be quiet to this. So there's a kind of a well-entrenched process that is taking place. And let's not forget, Rolf, that the meltdown, economic meltdown, the kind of money that was invested to bail out all these banks is also being invested in these land deals.
Oh, they're using like the TARP monies to buy land.
Yes, look at Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, and they have been eyeing the takeover of China's livestock industry. Morgan Stanley has purchased 40,000 hectares in Ukraine. And then you have Lancome, the British investment group, also bought 100,000 hectares in some other countries. Then we have the Swedish investing companies, Black Earth Farming and Alpcott Agro, who has purchased more than 300,000 hectares and in Russia, and also 128,000 hectares in South Korea. So, wow. These kinds of deals are taking place, and the investment firms, financial investment, they are moving into land investment.
Well, Dr. Sharma, let me ask you this. Do you have any hope? Is there any hope for us here?
Yes, there is hope, despite all these things happening, because the hope will come from the people. And the hope will come from resistance of the people. And I'm very hopeful. Look at Pakistan. There's a massive, massive resistance that is taking place within the country. In India, although all these things are happening, but if we haven't yet allowed the Daewoo or any other foreign company to come and buy that piece of land. There is a kind of a social unrest that takes place if that can take, that happens. But I'm gradually finding more and more people becoming aware. It was a hush-hush manner in which these deals
were
struck.
So this is happening. We all have to be aware of it. Dr. Devinder Sharma, thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope it's not 6 years until we talk again. Thank you all for tuning in. Stay tuned for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.